From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Climate change is a concern, so maybe huge funds shouldn't be investing in fossil fuels. Public health is a priority, so perhaps better not back companies that make sugary drinks. Welcome to the world of impact investing, where the idea is simple. You invest for social change. You do well by doing good. The concept has been around for a while, and more foundations, endowments, and pension funds are thinking about putting some of their huge portfolios into impact investments. But beyond straight profit, how do you best measure the returns, the doing good part? This hour on Point, the real impact of impact investing. And you can join us. What's your take on impact investing or socially responsible investing? How do we measure gains beyond annual rates of return? Or maybe are you skeptical of the idea? Do you wonder if there's a natural limit to how much good can be done if it's being funded by giant foundations or hedge funds, and if profit is even a tiny part of the motive? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining us first from Washington is Mark Gunther. He's a longtime journalist who covers business, sustainability, investing, and nonprofits. His latest four-part series on impact investing ran in the Chronicle of Philanthropy, and it's called Good Returns. We have a link to it at onpointradio.org. Mark Gunther, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Meghna.
So let me just start with, I'd love to get a little bit of the history of impact investing first for people who don't really know it. As you write, the idea first came about, what, roughly a decade ago and through the Rockefeller Foundation. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, the Rockefeller Foundation decided it wanted to put its grant money behind the idea of impact investing. So they held conferences, they created networks, they underwrote some organizations that kind of have become the infrastructure for impact investing. The irony of the story, though, is that when the then head of the Rockefeller Foundation, Judith Rodin, tried to get the foundation itself to put some of its substantial endowment into impact investing, the board of trustees said no. And that illustrates what I think is the problem in the foundation world, which is a very rigid wall between the people at the foundation who make grants, the program side of the foundation, and then the people who manage the endowment. And typically, but not always, never the twain shall meet.
Interesting. So what's the basic idea here? I mean, I reduced it down to the most simple terms about doing well by doing – or doing good by doing well. I mean, is that the general thrust here?
That's pretty much it. Okay. I mean, impact investing has a slightly more specific definition, which is investing in ways that deliver measurable social or environmental good. So measurable is a key. But the concept itself is, you know, at least 70 years old. You can go back to the mutual funds in the 1960s and 70s that didn't invest in weapons as a way to protest the Vietnam War. The anti-apartheid movement relied on impact investing, trying to get investors not to put money into South Africa. And then more recently, there has been the anti-fossil fuel movement. It's called Invest Divest in the world of foundations, asking the foundations to take their money out of fossil fuel money companies and invest it in businesses that are going to do good for climate.
Okay, so that's interesting because the three historical examples you just gave were roughly actually in the divestment side of things here and having an impact that way. But on the other hand, when it comes to impact investing, we're talking about where major funds or pensions or foundations are thinking about putting their money into, right? And so they don't necessarily want to put money into places where they're going to get zero returns or negligible returns. They still have a fiduciary responsibility to try and, you know, at least get some kind of healthy return for, you know, for their own investors or pension holders.
Yes, and you're absolutely right. Divestment is a relatively simple process. The argument behind it is relatively simple. The invest side of impact investing is a lot more complicated, and it does get into the core question of whether investing to generate measurable positive returns in the social and environmental side requires a trade-off in terms of financial return. And there's, heated debate about that inside and outside of the foundation world.
Okay, can we talk a little bit about that debate, because it's the heart of the question here. I mean, is the debate over how do you measure those non-monetary impacts, or is the debate over is there a limited efficacy to the idea of impact investing?
So Meghna, let's kind of break it down into two big questions. The first is, are you making a difference when you invest positively? And by that, I mean making a difference in the world. That's a very hard question to answer, how to measure that difference. The other, I'd say, controversy debate that's holding this field back in the foundation world and elsewhere is the question of whether investing to do good requires you to sacrifice some financial return. So I would say, taking the trade-off question first, Larry Kramer, who runs the Hewlett Foundation, very smart guy, he has made the case that foundations' best purpose in terms or best tool to do good is their grants. If they invest their endowments to try to do good, their endowments won't grow enough. They'll therefore have fewer grants and be able to do less good. So he's kind of the leading critic of the idea. On the other side of the debate, you have both some small and big foundations that have plunged into this, who actually can show through their track records, relatively short ones, but track records, that by investing entirely for impact, and I'm thinking here about a foundation called F.B. Heron in New York or Mary Reynolds Babcock, which is in the South, they both are 100% impact invested. And they will say, and they're right, that their returns in recent years have been just as good as the foundation average or even better.
Ah, okay. So then are they finding that they have the tools to accurately measure what those other returns are, or is that something that still other foundations and groups are struggling with?
I think there definitely is struggle there. And there's struggle for two reasons. One is if you invest, say, in a clean energy company, how do you really measure what would have happened had you not invested? Would someone else have come along and invested? That's the sort of counterfactual question.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you know, if there's consumer demand for solar power and you're investing in a company that makes solar panels, wouldn't the individual who put the solar panel on the house, even if they didn't go to your particular company, go to some other company? So it gets devilishly complicated very quickly, and even more so when you're talking about big public companies where foundations and others invest a lot of money. How do you measure the impact of a company like Walmart, for example? You know, you'll find people who say they don't pay their employees enough. You'll find others who say they've done enormous good by saving their customers lots of money, by selling them cheaper products. I don't know a way to actually balance and measure out those competing claims when it comes to a large company.
Yeah, so it is enormously complicated. But, I mean, I imagine that these endowments, funds, big pensions, or even, you know, private equity firms, that they do need some sort of measurable metric. That's a terrible way of putting it, but a set of ways to measure what the returns are, though. I mean, and why haven't we gotten better at that in the more than decade that this idea has been around?
Well, they'll tell you. I mean, there are definitely people working on this.
Okay.
I think the argument would be that it's just a very hard thing to track down. But I'll give you a couple of examples of people who are doing it. Mellon, a large asset management firm, has created what they call a low-carbon fund that essentially invests across every industry, including fossil fuels. But what they do is they select out those companies in the industry whose carbon footprint is lower than their peers. And so any investor can go to Mellon, or at least I think any institutional investor can say, I want to buy this fund. I want to have a diversified portfolio. I don't want to sacrifice returns, but I want to put my money into those companies that are outperforming their peers when it comes to climate change. That seems to me to be a thoughtful approach to the topic and also a way to measure impact that, you know, makes some sense. Now, is that going to change the world? I don't think so, but it will make some marginal improvements. More investment dollars will flow to the more efficient or the more low-carbon companies. And over time, that should reward those companies and encourage other companies to move in that direction. At least that's the theory.
I see. So that's a really interesting, and it's an example that one can wrap your head around. And yet,
which you can't.
And yet,
you want one other one?
Yeah,
there's
go ahead.
There's an exchange-traded fund that was actually created at the request of a small foundation called the Tara Health Foundation, funded by a feminist physician. And this fund is called SHE, S-H-E. And what they do is simply invest, again, very broadly across markets, but they put their emphasis on funds that on companies that have gender diversity both in their staff and on their boards. And again, the theory is if more investment dollars flow in that direction, it encourages companies to behave that way and create some change. And my argument in the story for the Chronicle is that foundations whose core purpose is to do good in the world as opposed to a pure investment fund or even a university or a public pension fund ought to use more of their endowment to try and align their investments with their values, that they're really missing an opportunity to both seek out and help create these opportunities for investments that do good.
But then that brings us right back to the pushback that you mentioned earlier about other people believe that the fund ought to invest so that it can make as much money as possible to do more grant giving. So we'll come back to this in just a second. Mark Gunther, stand by. Mark's written a four-part series called Good Returns in the Chronicle of Philanthropy. And we're talking this hour about how to measure the impact of impact investing. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about how to measure the impact of impact investing. And I'm joined today by Mark Gunther. He's author of a four-part series in the Chronicle of Philanthropy called Good Returns. It's all about impact investing. He's also a longtime writer for Fortune magazine as well. And joining us now from Boston is Governor Deval Patrick. He's the former governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, two-term governor for Massachusetts. And since 2015, he's been managing director and co-managing partner of Bain Capital Double Impact, the social investing wing of Bain Capital. They focus on bringing financial returns alongside creating social and environmental impact. Deval Patrick, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. It's great to talk with you again, Governor
Patrick.
Great
to talk with you, and it's great to listen to Mark Gunther. Yeah, I've been reading his wonderful pieces. He's one of the most thoughtful on this really terrific field.
And so you've got a kind of a unique experience here as having been in the public sector and now in the private sector. And so, first of all, I would love if you could give us an example of, a recent deal or investment that you've done with Bain Capital Double Impact that really sort of underlines what you're trying to accomplish now.
We invested in a company actually here in Boston called Penn Foster. It's been around a long time, started as a correspondence school, but today it provides online education to people trying to reach their educational and career goals. They serve about 170,000 students a year, mostly working people, often marginalized people, trying to lift themselves and their families through accredited and unaccredited programs, including high school, college, career, workforce development solutions, that kind of thing. And we were interested in Penn Foster really as a way of trying to get at the middle skills issue, which is a challenge in Massachusetts and around the country, something I became very much exposed to when we were dealing with the economic collapse when I was in office.
Mm-hmm.
And we had, I want to say, maybe at our peak, 170,000 people looking for work and about 120,000 open positions. And what employers were telling us, Meghna, was that they had they couldn't find people with the skills necessary for the jobs they had. And I think that's a problem we're seeing all over the country, and one that will continue to exacerbate, because there are folks, many of whom who have high school diplomas, but jobs that require more than that, but not necessarily a college degree. And so how, through low-cost, very directed, not the kind of train-and-pray solutions that you sometimes
right.
get in the training programs that that are available, we get solutions for people to get at those opportunities is something that I've been interested in.
Okay.
And that's an example.
Well, it's a terrific example, actually, Governor Patrick. So, but how then is Bain? I mean, look, Bain is very good at doing those analytics. So how is it that they're measuring the financial impact or gain from supporting Penn Foster mm-hmm. versus its material or social impact?
Sure. So let me give you, if I may, just a little context on what our fund is about, what Double Impact is about, because that'll just, you know, it'll give you a little color
yeah.
for how Penn Foster fits. Ours is a fund that is dedicated to both a commercial rate of return and measurable social or environmental good. And we've organized the fund into three sort of thematic verticals, health and wellness, sustainability, and what we're calling community building. And within health and wellness, we've been looking at ed tech companies that address either achievement gaps or skills gaps. And that's how we got interested in Penn Foster. When I say a commercial rate of return, I mean we underwrite to the same financial standards as the large cap funds, private equity funds here at Bain Capital. And that's not a value judgment about where others in impact investment choose to be, because others do make decisions to invest in companies or in enterprises that have a concessionary or lower rate of return. It's just that the types of investors who invest in Bain Capital types of products expect a commercial rate of return. And personally, I think, you know, if we are able to show at scale that you don't have to trade return for impact, I think it makes a pretty important point for investing generally.
But have you shown that? Have you shown that yet?
We have. And you have to wait for those results to be public, but that's the intention. And then in terms of the impact, we spent almost a year of homework just talking to everybody in the field, talking to investors and so on about how to think about measurement. And in the earlier segment, I know that Mr. Gunther was pointing out, and you have observed, that that part of this field is very yeasty. There's an awful lot of work and a lot of debate about measurement. Among the sort of the takeaways that from that year of homework that we brought into our business plan were two. One was, folks said, whatever you do, don't try to invent a unique, a unique measurement tool. Use something in general usage, because even though there isn't yet a gap accounting for impact, if you use something that is around at least an investor, an LP in our fund would be able to compare our performance on impact with another impact fund, so that they'll see how we're doing in the same way they would on financial
right.
terms.
Right.
And the other was, don't turn your companies into reporting agencies. Let them be mm-hmm. companies. So keep it simple.
Mm-hmm.
Pick one or two or three actionable measures that a company can manage to, and try and measure those at the outset, and as you go so that you can keep track of your progress. So we've chosen something called the GEARS survey, which is out of B-Lab in New York. And it's adaptable for those purposes, and we can draw a couple of factors out for each of our companies. We do that for each of the companies in the portfolio, and we measure the fund as a whole, and we report that to our to those who have invested in our fund.
So, Governor Patrick, I just have to say, you're talking now as if you spent your entire life in finance. So I'm impressed by how fast you've gone up that learning curve.
I'm trying to keep up, but you know, it's a really generous. It's a generous industry in the sense that folks are sharing a lot of their learning. They're very open to what they have, you know, where the pitfalls are and where the open issues and items are, and they've been very welcoming to me.
Well, hang on here for a second, because I just want to get Mark Gunther a chance to respond to what Deval Patrick here is saying. And just as another side note, when Governor Patrick mentioned GAAP standards, I believe you're talking about the generally accepted accounting practices standards.
Excuse me. I'm sorry, Magnus.
That's all right. But maybe there ought to be a set of GAAP standards for impact investing. That's probably a topic for another show or a finance and accounting publication. But Mark Gunther, what are you hearing what Deval Patrick is saying about what he feels that Bain Capital Double Impact is already accomplishing?
It sounds like a very thoughtful and sophisticated approach. I guess I have a couple of questions. One is, when you talk about a school, what would the metric be? Would it be number of students served, or would it be number of students who are actually placed in jobs? And then there's the other question that Larry Kramer of Hewlett brings up, which is, if you're delivering commercial returns as well as impact, how do you think about the counterfactual? In other words, had Bain not come along and invested in this school or that clean energy company, wouldn't another investor seeking commercial returns have come along anyway? And therefore, how do you think about measuring impact, or not measuring? How do you think about having impact under that scenario? That's why I have a bit of a bias towards investments that deliver concessionary or lower than market returns, at least in the foundation world, because foundations have the ability to make that compromise.
Got it. So a couple things. First of all, in our case, you know, Penn Foster would be measuring the number of students served in any event, because that's their bread and butter, and certainly we're taking account of that. But we're also trying to get at what's the delta in the impact in their lives. So if a student has taken a particular course because what they are trying to do is lift their standard of living as a result of that course, what has that course led to in terms of that job, in terms of a new job, and an income related to that job? So it's a little bit more, it's a little bit deeper. And I will say, as well, Mr. Gunther, this raises a larger question for us, and I think for the industry, which is, how do you assure that the impact lasts beyond your hold period?
Right.
If the hold period for a typical private equity fund is in the order of around 5 years, how do you assure that what you have brought to the table extends beyond the time that you own it? And that, I think, is certainly something we're thinking about and working on, and I think the industry ought to care about.
Well,
I'd also.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think Larry asked a fair, Mr. Kramer asked a fair question. I'm not sure it's one I've fret about too much. I don't think that other regular way private equity folks are saying, well, my goodness, if somebody else out there would bring another, would bring another regular way private equity fund to the table to compete, to invest in company XYZ, well, then we shouldn't be in the market trying to compete. To me, that's just not very compelling. What I will say is that we have met a number of entrepreneurs and founders in particular who tell us that because their enterprise is growing, they can attract capital. Mm-hmm. That isn't their problem. but they don't always find that they can attract capital interested in growing their mission alongside the commercial idea. And so we have been advantaged in some of those competitions because we're aligned with the whole of what that entrepreneur is trying to do. And we are trying to bring that additionality. So the in the case of Penn Foster, and by the way, I want to be absolutely clear, we are not making a value judgment about those who are bringing the concessionary capital.
Okay.
That's not the point.
Well, so Governor Patrick,
it's just a different place in the on the spectrum.
So can I just jump in here for a second, because that's exactly where I want to follow up with you on something. You know, so you're seeking a commercial rate of return in addition to the social impact return in the investments that you're making there. I heard you about, you know, no value judgments on those groups able to deliver lower rates of return, but I want to just sort of leverage your experience here as a two-term governor of a state as well, because when you were governor of Massachusetts, you worked with hundreds and hundreds of nonprofits who are doing great work. I mean, what is your response to the criticism or the concern from, you know, many corners that the whole idea of impact investing is flawed from the beginning, because even if there's a 0.005% rate of return expected, that's money that's not going towards doing the good.
Well, I hope that's not what impact investing, at least as we're doing it, is understood to be. In fact, I see impact investing as we're doing it as finally business coming off the sidelines. Instead of letting government and philanthropy, sort of clean up all of the mess, which is how it has felt from those perspectives, or from that perspective I've had in those sectors at different times and experiences in my life. This is not about this is about private enterprise doing its share in contributing in the ways it can to solutions that are bigger than any one sector can solve. And everybody has a contribution to make. Some of those solutions are going to be commercial. It's not about one sector saying, you know, I'll take it from here. Mm. I certainly don't think that this is about, private commerce saying there's no role for government, no role for not-for-profits, no role for philanthropy. That's not what this is. This is about the private sector and many, many private entrepreneurs saying, you know, there's something we can do here as well. Whether it's a regular way company saying that we can behave better, or a company like one we acquired in Texas that says, you know, there actually is a commercial idea behind the notion of diverting green waste from landfills where it would normally just decompose and turn into greenhouse gas. Gas emissions, and or create greenhouse gas emissions, and instead recycling it and selling it back as composted soil and ground cover. And it's a very profitable idea.
Well, Mark Gunther, we just got about a minute and a half here before we have to take another quick break. I'm wondering if you wanted to respond to what Governor Patrick is saying.
I'd actually love to ask him a quick question,
sure.
Which is, what's the size of the fund and where are the investors coming from? Are they pension funds, foundations? What's your largest category of investor?
The size of the fund is about just about $400 million, which is about 40% more than we set out to raise. I will tell you, to me, that's a lot of money. At Bain Capital, that's quaint. It's a charming
right.
little fund.
Right. Yes.
But we meant for it to be, in relative terms, small, because we wanted to perfect the model before we grew. Our investors are all types. They are public and private pensions. They're endowments. High net worth individuals. It's been quite a range, and it's been just an incredible journey. Particularly when you consider that many of our investors are folks who would not normally invest in a first time fund with first time manager.
Yeah.
At least in my case, a first time manager. But we've got 16 folks on the team now, and full time dedicated, and they are experienced investors from other Bain Capital businesses, from other middle market businesses, from other impact investment funds, and we're well on our way.
Well, Deval Patrick is the former two-term governor of Massachusetts, and beginning in 2015, he became managing director and co-managing partner of Bain Capital Double Impact. Governor Patrick, thanks so much for being with us today.
It's great to be with you, Meghna. Thank you for the show.
All right. Mark Gunther, stand by here for a second. We're talking about how to measure the impact of impact investing and whether, as Deval Patrick just said, it's finally time for businesses to come off the sidelines and do good and also do well, or maybe are you concerned that profit is any kind of motive when it comes to creating social impact and social change? We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about measuring the impact of impact investing. And Mark Gunther is with us. He's in Washington. He's the author of a four-part series called Good Returns on impact investing. And it appeared in the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Let's just take some calls here really quickly. Let's go to Alnur, who's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I've got a comment and a question. The comment is on this issue of the difficulty of measuring social impact. In my own work, I'm a professor at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. I've been researching exactly this issue, and I've got a book coming out on the subject that's called Measuring Social Change. And what I found is that it's actually very possible to measure social impact, both in nonprofits as well as in businesses that aim for some kind of a social return in addition to their financial return. And so I think there's lots of experiments in the works mm-hmm. that suggest that it's very possible. And if you just think about the infrastructure of analysts and rating agencies for for-profit firms, we're actually building that infrastructure now.
Yeah.
So hopefully it'll be possible to really do this in a systematic way across different types of companies in the future. The question that I have for your guests is, you know, if markets are to be a force for good, and if we accept that we'll never address climate change or the sustainable development goals without a role for businesses and markets, what is the future of how we as a society actually assess and rank the performance of companies? Like, do you envision a future where every company that's publicly listed, that's analyzed mm-hmm. sort of as a private company, is assessed both on its financial returns as well as its social returns?
Right, right.
And what do you think will be required for us to get there?
Alnur, terrific question. Thank you for your call. Mark Gunther, what do you think? Can we achieve a future where every company is measured by a double bottom line?
So I think it's possible, and I think this GEARS system that Deval Patrick mentioned, which is developed by B Lab, which is a terrific nonprofit that's in the heart of this conversation, is a place to start. I mean, my own view on this is a little bit complicated. I think foundations in particular should be doing more impact investing. It's part of their obligation. Having said that, I think the idea that in, you know, companies or financial markets are going to change the world is just a fundamentally flawed idea. I've paid attention to this for a long time. I don't think the financial markets are the solution to the climate problem. I think that takes politics fundamentally. I don't think they're the solution to poverty or anything else. You have to give businesses strong rules and strong incentives to act better.
If I could just inject my own personal real-world cynicism in here, I don't think we should rely on it either, because they're in the business of profit maximization. That's what they're in the business for. And if investors, you're even saying that these heavyweight foundations aren't demanding a double bottom line. And so if investors aren't demanding it or asking for it, I don't see any future in which entire markets are measured by these two metrics here. I mean, and also many of them would go out of business, by the way, if social impact became as important measure as profitability. But Mark, hang on here for just a second. I want to turn now, because we've been talking a lot about profit, and a big part of this picture is the role of nonprofits. So joining us now in the studio is Andy Posner. He's founder and chief executive officer of the nonprofit Capital Good Fund, which offers small personal loans and financial coaching to low-income individuals. They are headquartered in Providence, Rhode Island, and operate throughout Rhode Island, Delaware, Florida, Massachusetts, expanding to Illinois and Texas soon. So, Andy Posner, welcome to you.
Thank you so much. And this is really a critical discussion, because from my perspective, I think we have a fair amount of the solutions to some of the social and environmental problems we have. But the question is, how do we fund that? And impact investing is one of the ways to do so. But the question is, what expectation does the capital have when it's investing in nonprofits or for-profits?
Okay, but so your fund, the Capital Good Fund, is a nonprofit. So is the expectation of zero financial return?
Well, we're unique because we make loans, and we're trying to compete with payday lenders and others who charge 300% interest. And we actually can grow by borrowing from banks and individuals and other impact investors. The problem is, the impact investor wants to get a market rate return and market rate risk. And that's double-digit return and strong collateral and those sorts of things. And charging rates that are a tenth of those charged by payday lenders means that we can change lives and measure it and report on it, but we can't pay 15%. We can pay 5 or 6%. And the thing is that 10 percentage point difference means all the world. I mean, I can show you the spreadsheets and show you what it would take to pay the 15%. And I think what's pernicious about the notion that you can do well and do good is that you can in certain sectors, maybe it's agriculture or, say, wind energy, but in many cases you can generate a return, but you have to sacrifice something.
Yeah.
You have to be more patient. You might have to have a concessionary rate, like Mark was saying. You might have to be more patient with the returns.
I mean, Deval Patrick was talking about looking at an average 5-year time span for a lot of the investors that they may be working with. I mean, so when you say patient, you're talking about far more than 5 years.
Exactly. I mean, for us, we're hoping to be in a place where we can cover all of our expenses through earned income. And that's sort of the goal of social enterprise these days. But it's going to take us time. We think we can do it by 2024. So if someone wants to invest in us for 3 years, that's going to be difficult. And it also will put pressure on us to potentially charge more or grow faster than might be prudent.
So can I just jump in here for a second, Andy? And just to sort of I want to be sure that we're understanding exactly what the Capital Good Fund does. So you're not a foundation. You're not grant making. You're not a Bain Capital type social impact fund seeking commercial rates of returns. Did you say that you take loans from banks and then give that money out to social organizations?
Oh, no. Sorry. We actually make loans directly to low-income Americans.
Okay.
For things like buying a car or applying for citizenship or emergencies. So we're directly trying to compete, even though we're a nonprofit, with, say, payday lenders who charge 300% interest in many states.
I see.
But we're unique as a nonprofit. And there are many nonprofits that have a way to generate revenue. They just can't generate the rates of return that a traditional investor would expect. And the same is true of a for-profit. The difference is that we do also take philanthropy to supplement our expenses, to allow us to grow, and to do things like financial coaching that don't generate as much of a return.
All right. So you're giving people or groups access to capital who might otherwise have difficulty gaining that access.
Exactly.
And so is there any – you're a nonprofit though, so there's no profit coming back to you?
Correct. So, okay. But people can still lend money to Capital Good Fund. and we'll pay 5 or 6%. The challenge is that most money is going to seek a double-digit rate of return, and we can't generate that and still be equitable.
Yeah.
And the other thing I'll note is that lost in this conversation about impact investing is that not everything can generate a rate of return, or maybe even should. Like, you can't charge homeless people to stay at the homeless shelter.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to actually – go ahead.
No. I was just going to – sorry. You're hitting on what I just want to say is, I think, is one of the primary and important criticisms that we ought to explore here, right? Is what you're saying that there's a fundamental flaw to the idea of impact investing because there is the expectation of any kind of rate of return, and that there are many, many socially important endeavors and organizations that will never generate any return, financial, but a lot of social good. And that they would not fall within the aegis of these impact investing funds.
Well, so again, like with us, it's possible to generate a return and have impact, but not the kind of return that, say, Bain is looking for. And that's the issue. If the idea is that you can push a button and change the world by logging into your Schwab account and putting money into a different fund, that is not how we're going to solve the urgent social and environmental problems that we have.
Mm-hmm.
On the flip side, there are things that can only be impacted positively through philanthropy. And also, we have to have more government intervention. So there are very urgent issues, and we don't have time to wait for endowments to grow and then invest that for the highest rate of return and donate what they get back.
Well, you heard Deval Patrick. Oh, yeah. Mark, just hang on for one second.
Yeah,
I just want to ask. Oh, go
sure.
Okay. Go ahead, Mark. No, go ahead.
So, Megan, if I can jump in here, I think what Andy is saying, and this is what I've heard from other nonprofits, is there is a tremendous need for low-cost patient capital. Community development institutions that build housing or support charter schools or daycare centers, they can deliver a concessionary return to investors, but they can't compete with commercial returns. And the critique of the foundations is that they are not stepping up in anywhere on the scale that they should be to meet that need because of their devotion to maximizing the size of their endowments. And nowhere is it written in law or custom that foundations have to maximize their endowments. Nowhere is it written that they have to live in perpetuity. There are new foundations coming along all the time. And I think the argument that Andy is making is that there's a real opportunity here for foundations, as well as other investors who choose to make a real difference by sacrificing some return.
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm saying. And, you know, the same is true of for-profits. There are lots of business models for affecting real social and environmental change. The question is just, what does the investor expect from the entity? And if the investor expects double-digit returns, it's very difficult in most circumstances for there to actually be the mission piece of the puzzle achieved.
Yeah. So I'm hearing that there's room for all different sort of kinds of impact investing here. But Andy, if I may, I feel like are we just not getting at something fundamental? Because is there something – how do I put this? Is there something basically – I'm going to use your word – Pollyanna-ish about this idea even to begin with?
There is, but then others might say that I'm naive to think that you could drive hundreds of billions of dollars in capital to true – what I would call true impact – at a concessionary rate. But, you know, for instance, Muhammad Yunus, who won the 2006 Nobel Peace Prize.
Micro-lending guru.
Micro-lending guru. And we're a micro-lender in the U.S., basically. He argues that a social business should be an entity that focuses on solving poverty and that one in which the investor gets their principal back, no rate of return. He thinks you shouldn't earn any profit off the poor. Now, I don't agree necessarily with that, but a lot of people call him naive, but he's a Nobel Peace Prize winner. My issue is not with whether or not you profit off of these issues, but rather can you and actually address the issues.
Right. Well, let's see if we can sneak in at least a couple calls here before we run out of time this hour. Let's go to Debbie, who's calling from Pageland, South Carolina. Debbie, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for this show. I have a compelling reason to invest in and vote for anyone for clean air and clean water for my two grandchildren with asthma. The littlest one's name is Isaac, and he's been sick so often his dad nicknamed him I sick. I support Jay Inslee, I support Deval Patrick, and I support anyone who will do that. And now we've got a good monetary reason as well. Thank you so much.
Debbie, mm-hmm. thank you so much for your call. She mentioned Jay Inslee there, the governor of Washington State, so maybe talking about how voting is also part of the big, big picture here. Let's go to James, who's calling from New Haven, Connecticut. James, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I work in the nonprofit sector development, so fundraising, and I wanted to mention just a little bit about some of the impact that this can have sort of on the ground level as a fundraiser. And in the, you know, one of the main things that fundraisers are trying to do is articulate to their donors why their gifts matter, right? And when it comes to impactful or responsible investing, I get to make the argument to my donors that their dollars are doing double duty. They're supporting our organization, and their dollars are also, you know, in the form of our endowment, being invested responsibly. And I can tell you that being in the middle of an endowment campaign right now, more donors are asking about this.
Mm-hmm.
They want to know how our funds are being managed, and they're asking more and more about how responsibly it's being managed and not as much about how prudently it's being managed. And I'd love to hear what your guest has to say about that.
Yeah. James, thank you for your call. Andy, you want to jump in?
So the question being donors asking for this sort of...
He's saying more and more donors are actually asking for seeing some the double duty that he said that the dollars are doing.
They are, absolutely. But I think that the gatekeepers are reluctant because they're afraid that if they sacrifice some of the profit, they won't be maintaining their fiduciary responsibility.
Yeah.
They won't have as much money to donate. But I think the problem is, and Mark has written about this a lot, as have others, that if you, say, invest $1 million in a payday lender and you earn 15% and donate that money to Capital Good Fund, that's not enough for me to solve the problem.
You're still investing in the payday lender too.
Exactly. Whereas if you invest that in us, now I'm actually competing with them.
Yeah. Well, Mark Gunther, we've just got a minute to go here, but go ahead.
I mean, I think at a minimum what we should come away from this conversation with is an idea that organizations that are serving the public in some way, and I think I'd put a university endowment as well as an endowed foundation into this category, should at the very least make sure that their investments are not working at cross purposes to their mission and to their grant making. And this wall between the investment side and the grant making side needs to come down. It makes no sense to me that MacArthur and Hewlett and Packard and Bloomberg foundations are spending literally hundreds of millions of dollars supporting environmental organizations while on the investment side they're continuing to finance exploration for fossil fuels.
Well, that's the basic tension, right? And that we've kept coming to again and again here. But Mark Gunther, author of the 4-part series Good Returns, it appeared in the Chronicle of Philanthropy. He's also a longtime writer for Fortune magazine. Mark, it's been great to have you. Thank you for joining us this hour.
Thank you, Magna.
And Andy Posner, founder and chief executive of the nonprofit Capital Good Fund, which offers small personal loans and finance coaching to low-income individuals and some organizations as well. Andy Posner, thank you very, very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, James Ross, and Alex Schroeder, with help from Matt Hoisch, Asil Kibbe, David Marino, and Alex Pena. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.